Okay, well, thank you very much for joining us for this second session of the Blind Citizens Australia Convention. Again, we must thank our sponsors, Vision Australia, Virgin Australia, Humanware Australia, and also the Department of Social Services for supporting funding for some of our first-time attendees. How many first-time attendees in the room have we got? All right, well, we're going to get underway with our next session now. And to chair this session, I'd like to introduce a man who's our treasurer at Blind Citizens Australia. He also heads up the Finance, Audit and Risk Management Committee. The Farm, as we call it. Farmer Dan. Dan Stubbs. Welcome.
Thank you, Ricky. And welcome back after morning tea, everybody. It's I'm going to go straight into this session. It's my great pleasure to welcome Ron Hooton, who some of you may know about this little organisation called Vision Australia. Ron Hooton is the CEO of Vision Australia. He's also a recovering IT nerd. So any of you who are having trouble with having updated your phone to iOS 11, just come and see Ron after the session. He can help you out, okay? Please make very welcome Ron Hooton, ladies and gentlemen.
Thanks very much, Dan, and good morning, everybody. Morning. That wasn't particularly good, you know. Should we try that again? Yeah. Good morning, everybody. Morning. Way better. I do iOS 11, I don't do Android, I'm sorry. It really is a great pleasure to be at another Blind Citizens Australia convention. I was counting them up, and this is my sixth convention, and I've only been in the job 4 years, so there must have been a couple of state ones thrown in there. They're always a great opportunity to come and catch up with friends, colleagues, and a whole bunch of our clients. It's a good opportunity for us to be here. Myself, Andrew, our chair, and lots of our staff. Fred, thanks very much for a great address. I didn't want to go past the beginning of my address without acknowledging that, you come with such a lot of wisdom and you're very welcome any time in Australia. And we absolutely loved having you at Vision Australia these last few days. So thank you very much for your insights. The title of my address today is TEAM. One of those cheesy acronyms around Together Everyone Achieves More. And I thought about how I might go through this, and I'm going to make this interactive. So those people who are in the room who I know your name, you've got to stay alert. Because I may well ask you a question. But Marianne, I'm not going to ask you any questions at all, because it's about the NDIS, and you're the communications and information person for the NDIS, so you won't be picked on. It will be an interactive session. But there are just two or three things that I'd like you to take away from this. And that is that our sector, this blindness and low vision sector, needs more teamwork. It needs more together, everyone achieves more. The second message is that we're actually, when you look at the big numbers, falling behind in the NDIS already. We're only a little way through, and I'm going to cover that in just a moment, but we're falling behind. And we need to work as a sector, and I'm talking about organisations like Vision Australia, Blind Citizens Australia, and all of you who are clients, getting together to make sure that we get our fair share of the NDIS. So, why don't we start with a question? Who'd like to tell me, so far, how many plans have been issued by the NDIS that have blindness as the primary disability, blindness or low vision? Can anybody hazard a guess at how many of those plans? Stephen Bellman, where are you?
I would say probably under 1,000.
No, you're a bit south there, my friend. Anybody else? Mick, you're right next to Stephen.
Well, it must be over 1,000 then.
So, Mick, that says that your IQ is about 50 points ahead of Stephen's and Donald Trump's. Look, I'll save you the embarrassment, guys. It's 2,060 plans. But, you know, the big deal about that is that there have been more than 90,000 plans issued. So that's around about 2.3% if you do the maths. Can anybody just hazard a guess at what the population, the under 65 population of blindness as a proportion of the total disability might be in Australia. You know, how big is blindness in the under 65 group against all disabilities in Australia? That might be one that Marianne could answer. No?
She knows them all.
Look, it's actually 6%. And if you take a look at 2.3% of the plans having been issued to people who are blind or have low vision so far, and being 6% of the population, it feels like the sector is behind. So what's the average plan size in the NDIS? Now, I just did some rough maths here. We had one of Marianne's people come and talk to us the other day, and she gave us some interesting stats. But across all disabilities, what's the average plan size? I'm looking. Where's Crystal? Crystal, what do you reckon on the average plan size? All disabilities.
For all disabilities?
Yeah.
I really don't know.
Yeah.
They're very varied, the ones I've seen. They're really varied. I don't know. I'll say 20,000 just for
20,000? No. No.
I didn't think I was right.
It's actually around 80,000. There's been 7.3 billion so far and 90,000 plans issued. And a bit of long division, for those of you who remember slide rules, gives me $80,000. So what about blindness and low vision? What's the average blind and low vision plan? Graham, isn't this? Did I see your hand going up, Graham?
Yeah, I reckon I know that.
Oh, yeah, go on then, mate.
25.
Yeah, you're almost dead right. It's 24,000. Yeah. So when you look at that, the people getting issued plans, about a third of what we should have, and the size of the plan, about a third of the average, doesn't seem to me like we're really ahead. Now, I'm watching Marianne there. She's got a very pensive look on her face, and she's thinking, yep, his maths are right, but actually he's got it all wrong. And but I think that we need to be doing something about that. And I want to tell you just some stories. You know, there's a lot being made in our sector about competition. And we talk about competition between service providers, organisations being a great thing. But actually, I want to tell you a little story about competition between sectors. So, who knows? Well, no, that's not a good question to ask. I'll tell you the answer before I ask the question. The organisation that seems to have punched way above their weight in the NDIS so far is the autism sector. Now, we've taken a look at that, and what we find is that the autism organisations have got very, very close to their clients and worked out ways to get more money out of the NDIS. They've become very good at it, but they've also become very good at multiple disability, and I want to tell you a story that I think is really quite concerning. I had a conversation with a client a little while ago, and that client was saying to us, I've got a $20,000 plan. My autism organisation has told me I need $30,000, and actually some of that plan's also for blindness, but they've told me that Vision Australia is a big, rich charity, and that they can afford to give you the services for free, and we need all of that $20,000 because your child needs autism services more than they need blindness services. Now, that's a really, really interesting form of competition in an environment in NDIS where one organisation is grooming its clients to compete against another organisation. I tell that story not for a sense of shock or awe or anything like that, but just to say that within our sector, the competition between organisations is fine, but actually I think that the real competition that we're going to face is from other sectors being better at getting out of the NDIS what we need than we are. And I think a lot of that is in the relationships that they form. Now, I've been thinking about those relationships that we have within the sector, and so much of what the NDIS at least started off talking about was, hey, go out there, have lots of service providers, pick and choose between them, try and drive them down on price. But you know, driving people down on price doesn't always work. yep, you can compete on price if you're Shell versus BP or Coles versus Woolworths. But actually, when it comes to human services, relationships matter so much more. And what I'd suggest to you is that whether you choose Vision Australia or another one of those organisations that provide services, that you may well get a better deal bundling up all your services and going to that organisation and saying, I want a relationship with you. Because you can pay them the money that the NDIS gives, but you can ask for more value. If you drive down the cost of services provided by organisations providing those services, what we risk is that the next year the NDIS will take that money out of the plans and the money will go down. Because, you know, there's nothing more certain in the NDIS than the fact that there won't be enough money to service everybody. So I wanted to just share a few of those thoughts with you before we go on and talk about what it is that organisations like Vision Australia, organisations like Brian Citizens Australia and all of our clients can do to get a much, much better share of the NDIS wallet, for way of an example. Now, I heard Emma Benison coughing over there. Emma, I'm going to ask you that first question. I did that to you in Newcastle, didn't I?
Yes.
Yep. Emma, what do you think that we can do, you as CEO of Blind Citizens Australia and me as Vision Australia, what can we do to actually get a better share of the NDIS?
So I was just saying, I think that one of the things that's really important is to have these conversations as a sector. So, you know, Vision Australia as a service provider, BCA as a national representative organisation of people who are blind or vision impaired. It's very important that we have these conversations together because, of course, we all have unique needs. I think the other thing that we need to do is make sure, and this is really one of the reasons why I wanted Ron to talk about this topic today, we need to make sure that service providers and BCA are providing people who are blind or vision impaired, their families, their support networks with the best possible information and the most accessible information about what services are on offer and about what advocacy support people can expect so that they really can have choice and control. Because what this all comes back to, I mean, yes, the numbers are concerning and all of that, but what this comes back to in the end is that the NDIS is all about choice and control. It's all about putting the power back in the hands of us as people who are blind or vision impaired. And if we don't get this opportunity right, then we'll miss that opportunity to be in charge of our own destiny, as Fred said this morning. That's what's important about this. And I think the numbers come second to that. I think if we get that right, then the numbers will speak for themselves. That's all.
Emma, thank you. That's really good. Yeah. Not bad for off the cuff. You know, one of the... I'm going to ask you a question in a minute, John. Look, we're only 90,000 out of 460,000 plans through the NDIS, but one of the things I was pondering this morning was, what happens when we get to 460,000? And if blindness is still only 2% of those 460,000, and someone has to die for someone else to get back on? That becomes challenging, I think. But other thoughts on what we can do? Who's been through an NDIS process so far? Gentleman at the back in the blue shirt.
I've been through from the point of view of... not myself personally, but my wife actually been through from the point of view of autism, actually, rather than blindness. Yep. So I was just very interested in what you're saying, and actually maybe one of the issues you're looking at is a huge number of people who are autistic. And maybe that's one of the figures that actually kind of skews things a little. The plans, I don't think, are as big as you're actually thinking. They're for a limited number of years as well. So it's normally early intervention for kids.
Yep.
And so there may be some stuff that's skewing it. So I think probably Emma's just hit it on the head, actually, with what she was saying about how to approach it. That certainly made sense to me.
I've seen Debbie Cook's hand up. I've never been to a BCA convention where Debbie Cook hasn't spoken.
I don't talk all the time, but Ron, I'll just say briefly because I know we. I've been through an NDIS plan, and I actually say to people, I go for the lion's share, and I go for whatever I can get, and they go, oh, and I think, well, so what? And I've got some things in place that I wanted because I pushed for it, and I really don't care about what someone else might be getting or is getting or whatever. I'm going for what I want. So thank you.
So one of the themes that we talked about earlier was access to information, and NDIS has made the plans now accessible, but what sort of information could an organisation like Vision Australia do to help you with your planning? Is it something that we should be going along to planning sessions with you? Do you need particular help? Should we be producing a plan for a plan? Crystal.
Hi, thanks, Ron. I think one of the issues that has happened, and this is something I'm going to talk about later on this afternoon in the NDIS session, is that it seems that the service providers have been able to get their head around how this scheme is going to work, perhaps not totally, but a little bit more than people who are participating in the scheme have been able to. And so I think the role that the service providers have is to really clearly market what they actually do to the participants so that we know what we can ask for. I think it's a little bit too late when you've been to your planning meeting and you've been asked what you want or what you need, but you don't actually know what's available to you. I mean, one of the points of a market, and that's what this is supposed to be, is that people go out there and tell people what they're selling, and then we get to choose how we use it. That's the point of the scheme. So I would really be encouraging all service providers to really market what they do to the client base that they're trying to reach.
I'll come back to that in a moment. Graham Innes has shot his hand up, so there's obviously something you've triggered off there, Crystal, in his mind.
I just, thanks, Ron. I'd like to reinforce Crystal's point. I'm at the point of looking, of applying now, but I haven't had the planning meeting. And I thought the webinar that Vision Australia did recently on the NDIS was really valuable. But the one criticism of it that I would make was that it did not have concrete examples.
Yeah.
So for each of the points or the areas where you can apply for stuff in the NDIS, I would have benefited by saying one person asked for this, but another person asked for that, and five or six examples of what people were, so that it gives us a range of thoughts. And don't have to be limited by that range, but it gives you a base to work from.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing that seems to happen in plans that we see quite a bit, and there's a little bit of a discussion on the BCA list at the moment where there's a fellow who wanted a microwave. And you quite often get this, my mate got a microwave, so I want a microwave too. What we've told our service providers is, in terms of the goals that a person has, in terms of what they want to achieve, what is the best way of achieving that? It's a very individualised thing, Graham, and it is hard. What I'm hearing from you is case examples. Yeah. I can't remember which jolly you are. Sorry, there's so many of you here.
It's Bridget.
Hi, Bridget.
Perhaps if we're trying to escape from someone copying in a way that may not fully benefit them, having examples, I agree, would be a really good case. And having as many examples as possible so that then they probably will realise that not all those suggestions are going to be appropriate for them. So having a wide range, and then they can go, well, obviously these aren't all for me.
Yeah.
But I hadn't thought of that one, and I hadn't thought of that one.
One of the things we've been thinking about doing, and we don't quite know how we do it yet, but there is a fair amount of variability in the planning process with NDIS, and that's because there are so many assessors and so few that have direct blindness experience, that we're looking at building our own assessment that might take a person's goal and almost do a pre-plan that they could take along to the NDIS. Would people find that helpful? The lady in red down the back there.
Just to add to what Graham said about the examples, I think it would be good to have the examples, but also identify how that, whatever it was that they got, had paid for, how that met their need, so that, you can identify specifically what your need is and how, what was purchased for you or what services you got actually met that need, to as a way of, so that everyone doesn't say, well, he got a microwave, I need a microwave too.
Yeah.
Just a bit more specific.
It's a really interesting and difficult one to traverse, that particular issue. What we have said to our staff is that you must use evidence. you must use evidence that says that the best way that this person's needs can be addressed is through this mechanism, as opposed to being advocates. I mean, we're trying to get the best possible package for people out of the NDIS, but only where it's supported by evidence and need. And thermomixers seem to be so popular everywhere. Newcastle started the problem. Okay, who's next on the questioning? Lady over there.
Just wondering if Vision Australia has a newsletter or something that goes out to its clients and in all different formats of their preference.
Absolutely we do, yep.
But I think, you know, whatever you need to do needs to be, you know, I guess disseminated to people so that when they need it, they've got access to it. It's just because the NDIS is rolling out across the country over a period of 2-3 years, it's going to have to be a slow process, I guess. So, if you're going to target people now, some people are going to put it in the back burner and not worry about it because it hasn't rolled out in our area just yet, you know. But if you have it there, at least people can say, well, you know, this is where you can go for information.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
we've got about 50 hands up in the room. This is good.
It's Carmel.
Hi, Carmel.
I think one key issue is talking with each other and with clients from a Vision Australia point of view, the language.
Yep.
NDIS language is very different to what we are used to. So I think just even to go back a step, we need a ready reckoner of what the NDIS language is and how you can use that language in your plan so that you can get a positive outcome.
Sort of like a glossary of terms.
Yeah, glossary of terms. You know, your goals, your needs, and even then converting it back into Vision Australia language as well, is that, you know, we have to have an individual service plan. And, you know, talking about plans and what the differences are. And I think language is very important because it is a whole new world for us.
Thanks, Carmel. Lauren.
Just to play devil's advocate slightly, I just want to remind everyone that all of these things we're talking about right now, we need to find ways of replicating them for people who the NDIS is never going to apply to. I'm very protective of our members who are over the age of 65, so I just want to remind people of that.
This definitely applies to my aged care as well. There's something we've been talking a lot about recently is the gap between frail elderly where the my aged care seems to be focused, which seems to kick in around 80, and age 65. That is a huge gap and something that we're definitely advocating with BCA around. Oh, a question down the back there. Yeah, yeah. Thanks, Bridget.
Thank you. It's Sandra Wibberley speaking. I think what's going to be real, and it is very important because the service is at risk of losing clients too, and they've lost me. Engaging in principles of customer service, like returning phone calls. I rang on the 15th of June to arrange an adaptive technology assessment, an OT. It took 3 months for Vision Australia to get back to me, by which time I'd gone elsewhere. So I think, you know, that sort of stuff needs to be dealt with. It's far more basic.
So if that happens to you again, you can send me an email. My email address is on the website. That isn't what we do as a normal course of events. There must have been something just happened. So sorry about that.
We have a question over this side, thank you.
Who's next? Oh, round here, thank you.
Hi. I'd just like to make some overarching sort of comments. To pick up on Emma's point about we need to have conversations and some of the other points. So I think it's about sticking to the point of the NDIS, which is choice and control, you know. And it's about having those conversations about what are the better ways and how better to pick up on Fred's talk this morning about learning from your peers and learning from your colleagues. Like, how best do people use a microwave? Is it about the right choice of microwave? Is it about design and what I intend doing with it and so on and so forth? But also from a service provider point of view, I think you're actually missing an opportunity. If you'll do good OT, you could do good OT for a whole range of people.
Yeah, we
or
don't have
an... if you did a good computer training, you could do it for a whole range of people. So I think this is the point where we have to think laterally.
Sorry, question here. She's
I've
finished.
Been given a two-minute warning as well, by the way. And, sorry, can we go to Marianne? Because, I mean, I kind of feel like you might want a slight right of reply here.
Okay, thanks, Ron. And I totally agree and share the view that these kind of conversations with each other, particularly across the sector, are really important. I think it's also important to think of the context. You use numbers and talk about them. The NDIS is only part of a much bigger system called the National Disability Strategy that John talked about. And it is a big part, but it's the part that's got attention because it's got money. So the scheme is being rolled out or introduced over 3 years. So the numbers of children and children with autism and that may appear high, but for example, in South Australia, only children have come into the scheme. In some parts, certain jurisdictions have come in. On the 1st of November, this part of Melbourne will come in, and let me tell you, there's an awful lot of blind people who live in this part of Melbourne. So that may impact on the numbers. You know, and, you know, it is an individual scheme. So someone who's blind, my age, an older person, but still under 65, is going to have very different needs to a blind person who went blind yesterday. So I don't think that we should be thinking, you got something, I want something. And I also think that we need to not just think of success as dollar value. Success, yep. The NDIS is very much... The NDIS is very much about you determining your goals, you achieving outcomes, not transactions, not I went to the shopping centre 6 times. What did that do to change my life? So I think we have to, as Carmel said, think about language, but think about it from a different perspective than we're used to. But we, as blind people, as people with disabilities, have to demand from other government services, health, justice, transport and that, our rights for inclusion. They should not be picked up by NDIS. Sorry for the rant.
Marianne, thank you for that. We, as an organisation, completely and utterly agree with you. It is about outcomes. It is not about the money. And that's why quite often we don't recommend microwaves where they're not justified. But look, I've been given the big wrap-up.
Sorry, this lady's been waiting quite a while. Is it okay if she fits it in?
Well, it's Dan's session, but look, let's go for it. Sorry, mate.
I was just going to say, unfortunately, I'm from WA, so we don't have the NDIS yet. But being a person with multiple disabilities and medical conditions, I find it really hard to find a service provider that's willing to take on my case and meet all my challenges, even with the funding that I do get at the moment.
Annabella, we do work with people with multiple disabilities, so if you wanted to talk to a Vision Australia person, we would certainly be happy to help you out. Look, I've had the big wrap-up from Dan. Do you want me to just say one or two concluding words, or do you want me to wrap up right now?
I want you to wrap up right now.
Okay.
Dennis, Marianne took your time from that unpaid ad from NDIA.
Excellent.
All right, would you all please thank Ron Hooton for that excellent interactive presentation. And just a few words from our president now.
Thanks, Dan. What a great way to extend our discussions this morning. And look, I appreciate that there were all sorts of hands up there, and it's a burning issue for so many of us. I remind you that after lunch we have sessions, parallel sessions, one looking more particularly at the NDIS, the other looking at my aged care. So I'm sure with Lauren and Crystal in the lead for those two sessions, there'll be an opportunity for you to expand on some of those discussions. I would take the opportunity to remind you that when you address the convention, please give us your name. We've got probably 40% of the people in this room are first or second time attendees, so we're not all known to each other. So it's really helpful if you can give your name when you make an intervention. Ron, I particularly pulled rank to get this opportunity to thank you because I want to do a couple of things. Firstly, the theme that you chose strikes a real chord for BCA, and as you know, and some people in the room know, We have recently developed and are now implementing a terrific MOU with Vision Australia, which isn't just about the fantastic financial support that they give us, but it's about these sorts of relationships and about where we can use an opportunity like this to bring a large number of blind people together, or a smaller number in a different circumstance, to provide Vision Australia with that sounding board that Ron has sought this morning. So you are as much part of this conversation as Ron was, and I thank you all for your interventions, and I know that you would have liked to extend it for the rest of the day. I mention the MOU because it's a very important element in the current operation and functioning of BCA. As I say, it provides financial support. It also provides a mature working relationship between our two organisations. It's facilitated in the main between Emma as our CEO and Karen Knight as the relevant general manager within Vision Australia. Ron and I leave it to them, unless we have to sort out their fights, which we haven't had to do yet, have we, Ron? So I did want to publicly acknowledge the important relationship with our two organisations, and this was an opportune moment. But the theme also struck a chord with me in terms of us working together in this sector, because there's a level above this that I'm concerned that as mature organisations we all look at. One of our problems in this sector at the moment is we have a diversity of what we might call peak bodies. There's the Australian Blindness Forum, there's Vision 2020 Australia, there's the Roundtable on Information Access, there's SPEVI, the South Pacific Educators of the Vision Impaired, and then there are smaller groups. If we're going to consolidate as a sector, my challenge to the leaders of our organisations, and I put myself right in the forefront of this, is that we start and look at pulling those organisations together. I particularly, at this point out that I sit at many meetings of the Australian Blindness Forum, I sit at many meetings, or until recently have sat at many meetings of the Roundtable on Information Access. Two organisations coming from the same point of view, talking about many of the same things, but there's a duplication there that gives government leverage to keep us separated and apart, and I think it's high time that we start to rationalise those things. I enjoy very much my work with chairing the Independence and Participation Committee of Vision 2020, but again, I see the same faces as I do at ABF and in other forums, and I think that not necessarily by scrapping them all and having one giant organisation, but we need to find ways to rationalise those functionings so that we're better working together at that leverage level. So, Ron, thank you for today. You've sparked some interesting discussion here. I hope that you and your Vision Australia colleagues got some good feedback out of the session, and I thank everyone who contributed to that. I acknowledge the relationship between our organisations, but I also, on BCA's behalf, declare that we're very keen to see that peak level activity rationalised so that we're better representing the sector. Would you thank again Ron Hooton?
Thanks, John. And just to add to that, I think it's terrific that Ron's now at his at convention number 6. I think I heard him say earlier on. It's my great pleasure now to welcome to the microphone Lauren Henley, our National Policy and Advocacy Officer. I've known Lauren for many years in different roles, and I think she is actually one of the smartest people I know. She is a great policy analyst, an excellent writer, and as an organisation, I think we're very lucky to have her in this role as one of the many leaders in this organisation. Would you all please welcome Lauren Henley?
Thank you for that very warm welcome, Dan, and for those very nice words. I don't really know what to say. So access to information, I think often we can tend to think about it as a matter of convenience, but it's actually a human right. And if we don't fight for it, nobody is going to have that fight for us. For those of you who don't already know me, I'm the Policy and Advocacy Coordinator at BCA, and I help to coordinate our national campaign work. And I'm really passionate about bringing all of you, our members, along on that journey. I'm going to give you a quick rundown of some of the more systemic work we've been doing to advocate around issues relating to information access, and then I'd really like to hear from all of you so I can try my best to answer any questions you might have. All right, so let's get started. Technology can be one of our closest allies when it comes to providing us with access to information, but in the absence of enforceable standards to regulate the accessibility of this new technology, to regulate the accessibility of this new technology, it can also be our greatest enemy. Until recently, entering a PIN into an FBOSS machine was a task that most people who are blind or vision impaired could complete confidently and independently using a tactile keypad. There are a set of voluntary banking standards on accessibility that have been in place since 2002, which were developed by the Australian Bankers Association in consultation with disability organisations. Despite the fact that these standards remained voluntary, banks generally complied with them by default in the development of FBOSS devices because there was little room for variation in design with those machines. Enter touchscreen technology, that's where it all started to change. One bank in particular had a head start on this and started rolling out a device that was touchscreen only. So unlike older devices that were around, it doesn't actually have a physical keypad, so it's touchscreen only. The bank in question had built in an accessibility mode to try to allow people who are blind or vision impaired to enter their PIN independently. But at this stage, it still falls well short of our needs, which means that many people who are blind or vision impaired are being forced to tell their PIN to someone else just so they can complete a simple transaction. We're currently working with that bank to try and resolve some of those issues, and they're trying to improve the accessibility of the device. But I don't think we can focus too much on that one bank either, because other banks are also now starting to roll out touchscreen devices. This includes ATMs as well as FBOSS terminals, and they have the potential to be just as problematic. So what we need is a more systemic approach to this problem. Earlier this year, the Australian Bankers Association released a draft set of guiding accessibility principles for banking services in an attempt to modernise and update the voluntary 2002 standards. We prepared a submission to provide feedback on that document, which highlighted the need for a more closely regulated approach to accessibility within the financial services industry. If financial institutions do not have strict standards that they're required to follow, they're each likely to develop accessibility systems using different protocols or platforms, resulting in very little consistency for the consumer. And that's assuming that accessibility has even been considered at all. Once these things are being rolled out, it's a much more difficult issue to tackle. So we need to put something in place that will guarantee that accessibility is considered in a consistent manner from the outset. In response to our submission and submissions that were prepared by a number of other stakeholders, the Australian Bankers Association has established a new accessible banking task force to look at the option of developing a more enforceable set of standards in greater detail. Our advocacy officer, Ricky Chaplin, is BCA's representative on that task force, but it's really early days and the task force still hasn't actually had its first meeting. Because this issue is resulting in a breach of privacy and forcing people into the situation of having to breach the e-payment code by telling their PIN to a third party, we're also exploring options for pursuing it with the Office of the Information Commissioner and the Australian Security and Investments Commission. So keep watching this space. That's what's happening in regards to access to financial services. So I'd like to move on now to one of my favourite topics, access to television. Many of you have already been following our campaign work around audio description on television very closely, but a quick recap for those of you who are less familiar with audio description, or AD as we more commonly call it. It's a service that provides a verbal narration of visual elements that appear on screen to make television content accessible to people who are blind or vision impaired. And it's a service that's already existed on free-to-air television in all other English-speaking OECD countries for many years. In fact, iconic Australian programs such as Neighbours and Home and Away are currently audio described for overseas audiences, but are still not accessible to Australians who are blind or vision impaired. Australians who are deaf or hearing impaired, on the other hand, enjoy comparatively high levels of access to television because the Broadcasting Services Act now requires 100% of content that is broadcast between 6 a.m. and midnight to be captioned. In April this year, Minister for Communications Mitch Fifield announced the establishment of an audio description working group. The purpose of this working group was to bring together representatives from the broadcasting and streaming industries, audio description service providers, and consumer representatives to explore options to increase the availability of audio description services in Australia. I'm BCA's representative on that working group, and I've attended 3 meetings so far. The final meeting of the working group is scheduled to take place on the 27th of this month, at which point the Department of Communications will sit down and start to draft a report to government on behalf of the working group. The report will make a number of recommendations about how to proceed with the matter of audio description on television and is due to be handed down to government by the end of December this year. One of the things that's been clear with the working group from the start is that the government's not interested in introducing a legal requirement for broadcasters to deliver audio description. Instead, they're exploring a more industry-led approach where we try to work collaboratively with industry through the AD working group to make audio description happen. We've had a few frustrations with that approach from the start. So firstly, because we've been lobbying industry for a very long time and they've had every opportunity to come to the table and make this happen. And secondly, because an industry-led approach would not provide us with any enforceable human rights protections. If requirements for captioning are included under the Broadcasting Services Act, why should things be any different for our community? And so it was that we went down the path of doing some extensive campaign work around the Broadcast Amendment Bill that was recently debated in the Senate. The Broadcast Amendment Bill sought to make a number of amendments to the Broadcasting Services Act, and we saw this as a unique opportunity to lobby for minimum targets for audio description on television to be introduced into the Act as well. Our lobbying efforts around the Broadcast Amendment Bill allowed us to engage in a meaningful dialogue with members of the Senate about the importance of audio description on television. And as a result, a lot of politicians are now on our side. An amendment relating to audio description on television was put forward by Green Senator Rachel Seward during second reading speeches on the Broadcast Amendment Bill in the Senate. The amendment won a vote on the floor during the committee stage of the debate and was supported by Labor, the Greens, and the majority of the crossbench. While we weren't successful in having minimum requirements for audio description introduced as part of the Broadcast Amendment Bill, our efforts have moved us one step closer to our final goal. We've now paved the way for a separate bill relating to audio description to be introduced into Parliament in the future, if and when this is necessary. A record of who supported the amendments relating to audio description on TV is also now permanently on the public register. So when those parties are in a position to make policy in government, we can remind them of the commitment they made to the issue of audio description in the Senate this year. I want to remind you though, that the one thing that made this campaign every success that it was the grassroots advocacy of our community. The tireless dedication of our members helped us to clearly demonstrate consumer demand for audio description on Australian television. We want to thank everyone who took the time to phone or email a senator to get their point across. We couldn't have done this work without you. So where to from here? We still have a couple of further options up our sleeves in the event that the AD working group does not produce tangible results. But at this stage, I'm feeling more and more confident that it might actually give us something. Right now, I can tell you this. The AD working group is looking at 3 distinct options for delivering a permanent audio description service and the pros and cons associated with each. I need to represent the views of the wider membership when I approach this issue with government, so I'm relying on all of you to tell me what you think. I'll be undertaking a few different consultation activities over the coming month to gather feedback from members in relation to the 3 options that are on the table. Here's some homework for you in the meantime, though. One of the 3 options being considered relates to a variation of a service called Big Access Media. If you have an iPhone, visit the App Store, enter the words Big Access Media into the search field, and download the app to check out how it works. You can also visit the Big Access Media website at www.bigaccessmedia.com. And if you don't have access to a smartphone, there's still ways in which the service can be delivered to you. You can contact Big Access Media by phone on 02-9337-1213 to find out more. And the last thing I'd quickly like to talk to you all about today also relates to access to TV. Is anyone out there familiar with the program Australian Story on the ABC? Yeah. Okay, so it's been an issue for us for a long time because the program's relatively easy to follow for the most part, but at the end of the program, some text appears on screen to tell you how the story ends. It's not spoken out loud, so for us, it's kind of like getting all the way through a book, only to find that the last page is missing. Australian Story is just one example, but on-screen text can be hugely problematic because it's used in a lot of different contexts, and all networks are guilty of using it in one form or another. It's important that we treat this as a separate policy issue, distinct from the issue of audio description on television, though. Why, you might ask? We deserve to have access to all on-screen text, and if it's tied in with the issue of audio description, a lot of that access will be lost. Even once we get something over the line in terms of securing a permanent audio description service on Australian television, this will initially only cover a small percentage of content that is broadcast each week. So let's say we end up with 14 hours of content per week as a starting point. If we haven't tackled the issue of on-screen text separately, that would mean that every skerrick of on-screen text that appears outside of those 14 hours would still be completely inaccessible to our community. And quite frankly, it's not good enough. We're looking at lodging some complaints in relation to this issue with the Victorian Civil and Administrative Tribunal. And the reason we're tackling Victoria is because at this stage, this particular process has the potential to provide us with more tangible results than some of the other existing complaints mechanisms. So if you live in Victoria and you're interested in pursuing this matter further, then please get in touch. Right now, though, we have the potential to make some inroads with the ABC specifically. ABC TV is currently in the process of developing a new guidance note on accessibility. The ABC already has a number of other guidance notes in place covering a range of different issues. These guidance notes are distributed to all content producers who work with the ABC and are generally followed very closely in the development of new television programming. We're seeking to have issues relating to the lack of spoken announcements for on-screen text resolved through the ABC's guidance note on accessibility, and we need your help. If this is an issue you're passionate about, then you can contact the ABC's editorial director, Alan Sunderland, to tell him what you think. You can email your comments to alan@sunderland.alan@abc.net.au. And if you don't have access to email, you can contact the ABC by phone on 13 99 94. Alternatively, I'm more than happy to record your feedback over the phone and pass on your comments to Alan. If you do provide feedback to Alan in relation to this issue, though, it'd be really great if you could get in touch with me and let me know. And that's because it will help me to develop an evidence base that can be used to follow up with the managing director of the ABC in the event that this guidance note does not provide the level of accessibility we're seeking. Okay, one more thing I'd like to say, and that's that for me, what I've really enjoyed seeing of late is an increase in the level of engagement from members. People have been calling me up or emailing me with their own suggestions and ideas about how we can tackle different issues, and that's what I want to see more of. BCA is your organisation, it belongs to all of you, and you can have your say in anything we're doing or anything you think we should be doing. I have one example in particular that will show you that we actually listen. Is Wayne Hawkins in the room? Yes? What you might not know, everyone else in the room, is that we owe a lot of our recent successes around the Broadcasting Amendment Bill to Wayne. Wayne had heard about the amendments the government was proposing, and he saw an opportunity, so he promptly contacted us to tell us what he thought needed to happen. We listened to what Wayne had to say, and it led to something amazing. But Wayne was also there with us every step of the way. Wayne, on behalf of Blind Citizens Australia, I want to thank you for the enormous contribution you've made to our campaign work this year. Sorry guys, I think I took up your question time, but happy to take any.
So we can take a couple of questions if people can put their hands up, and we'll take just two questions. Hopefully from maybe someone who hasn't asked a question yet. Do we have any? Lauren, you've answered everyone's questions.
Oh, jeez.
Bill Jolly hasn't spoken yet, so we'll take his question. Amazing.
I'll ask the question and then, in fact, I think I'll answer it. Lauren, how can you make such a magnificent presentation? And what Lauren was doing was listening to her jaws and reciting what the jaws were saying. That was a fantastic effort. And as a Braille reader, I know I can't do that, but... I recognise that we can't all use Braille. Our personal situations are different. But that was a fantastic effort, and congratulations on that presentation and the method you gave.
Thank
delivered
you,
it.
Do we have any questions on topic?
Sorry, Dan, I put my hand up before you said on topic.
Yeah. Okay, typical. Go on.
I just wanted to say that I just wanted to thank Lauren for all the work she's been doing on behalf of all of us. Lauren's been spending quite a lot of time travelling back and forth, and she spends a lot of the time when she's not in Melbourne at my house. And so I can totally 100% testify that she works her butt off for this organisation, and I just want her to know that we all appreciate that. So thank you.
Was Crystal Malcolm, I think.
Yeah. My ego is getting way too big. Yeah. You're going to have to ask again.
I think that's quite enough. We'll not get Lauren out of the room. Would you all please, again, thank Lauren Henley. Great coverage of the variety of advocacy work going on in this organisation at the moment, and I really endorse the particular comments that Lauren made about the high level of engagement by members. That's so powerful, and it's proven really powerful for this organisation in some of its advocacy work, because there can only be so much done by someone sitting in the BCA office working out the material. We actually need numbers to really make that advocacy work and bring it alive with politicians and in the media and so on. It's now my pleasure to introduce to you Tony Starkey. Tony's going to talk to us about another aspect of access to information, the Marrakesh Treaty, copyright, and things like development of centralised catalogues. What's it all mean? I don't know. Would you please welcome Tony Starkey, who is he works at RSBSA, and he's the policy officer for the Australian Blindness Forum. Please welcome Tony.
Thank you. Is that working good? I firstly would like to acknowledge that I'm presenting this paper on behalf of Jennifer Grimwade, our Executive Officer of the ABF, who's due to family commitments is unable to attend. So I've done that. I'd also like to acknowledge that I cannot do jaws in the ear and talk at the same time. And also... The motivation is gone. Also, probably 40 years ago, I should have been a really good boy and kept up my Braille so that I could present like Bill does when he presents and Graham and so forth. So one message I always give to young people who have got low vision at the start or may have the... If you're not sure if your vision's going to last your life, I suggest you learn Braille. Okay, the ABF, the Australian Blindness Forum, is the peak body, and whilst I take John's comments in place, is the peak body of the rehabilitation section of the blindness sector and the health of where we sit. We are also the member of the WBU, as the Australian member, and we have our delegates, and along with the members of ABF, which are made up of service providers and the consumers with BCA. We have a board with BCA having two spots, and there's another six people with an independent chair that form the board of ABF. We're member driven and have to rely on the funds that are provided by our members. Now, while we're talking about information, it's such a wide area of access and so forth that we talk about. The majority of the work that is done through ABF is either as a voluntary area or at the commitment of the agencies that are members to put the effort in and work and so forth to form our policies. and 90% of the time, probably 95% of the time, they reflect the consumer and the service provider part of the sector, and also of where we go as far as international commitments and go as along the way. We have 16 members, and we're hopefully trying to ensure that all states are represented on that board. Okay, Marrakesh, you've heard a lot about it over the years, in the last 5 or 6 years. Marianne knows more about it than anyone. But whereas I'm talking about is the context of how we're looking at it since it was ratified and also became into force. And I believe there's something like over 32 countries now that have committed to it, signed it up. So from an Australian point of view, that now allows us to to swap information with other countries. And I believe that there's probably quite a bit going on between CNIB, Vision Australia, RNZFB, in the specialised areas of information. The area we're looking for is to get the European or English, very sad, it used to be very simple, it was going to be the European Union, now it's going to be England and the European Union. America is also another area that we wish to sign the treaty and so forth. So that made a big impact to what is available and how quickly we could get some information across available in Australia. The Attorney General's Department or Department of Communications with the Copyright Department has supported the sector very well over the past 10, 15 years into getting to where we are with Marrakesh today. And last year they passed the, and it was ratified, confirmed by the Senate this year, of the changes to the Copyright Act to enable Marrakesh to be implemented a lot easier than what it was, to remove the confusion about how it's implemented, and also the fair dealing copyright amendments that came through this year as well, which also assists and the blindness agencies and also any library that wishes to participate in that process to provide information quickly from other countries that have already signed up. So we're very happy with the work that we did that. That's taken a lot of work through the agencies and also through, as even John mentioned before, the round table. We've put a lot of work into that through various areas to get where we got today. Last year, the ABF organised a meeting of the libraries, probably six main producers or specialist libraries in Australia, to come together and to see how we could move forward with Marrakesh and how it would implement some changes to the way we did access to information or provided it to people. We had a meeting in Canberra and we went through about four different options of what would be nice to achieve. We did all agree that in a perfect world, a central repository would be a good thing to have. However, that presents a lot of problems of one of how do you get that information there and also how do you provide access. The Marrakesh Treaty does not allow, to my knowledge, individuals to access the information. It must go through a recognised body or a blindness agency or library. So we've got to have some sort of a structure of how that's accessed. The group came together and decided that a central repository would be good, and so we started going along those lines to trying to achieve that, and we contacted the National Library of Australia, and they have a wealth of information that is totally inaccessible to us. They have lots and lots of stuff. I think I read that there was 37,000 books or something, but they're all either held in print or in what they call digitised format, which of course is not an accessible format. So we've been advocating through ABF and other bodies for a long time now to try and get access through the National Library. If you go to the National Library, they will agree that that would be a wonderful thing. If you don't bring any money to them, They unfortunately can't talk to you because they've got no money. So we've tried to change their policy and change government policy to take into account that the needs of access to information. We have a lot of elements of access to information. As Lauren said, it's to do with television, audio description. And probably on that note, for those people who are not aware, Fred Schroeder and I are the only ones wearing ties in this organisation today. Not that that's relevant to the issue, but it does give an information where if you can't see, you don't know what's moving around the world. If you can't access the information, you're held to ransom by others in the community. So we have went to the National Library with our concerns, and we've started off a process where we're trying to encourage the Trove database, which the National Library organise. The Trove database is a search facility, and it gives you access to quite a bit of information and also formats of books and so forth. But the key word that's missing for us is whether it's an accessible book or in what format it's in. So we've asked the National Library to present as with a field within their search engine to allow us to search for accessible, audible, braille, e-text books. At the same time, we've been talking to them about changing the concept of the legal deposit system, which is a where all books that are released or produced in Australia are lodged with the National Library as part of the Cultural Collection of Australia. And previously they've always been lodged in print. Over the past couple of years they've amended their rules so that they can now be lodged electronically. And what we're asking for is to have them lodged in a format that would then be easy to change into an accessible format, either through braille, large print or audio. So we will be continuing to have that conversation. The words in their eyes is that a couple of years is not too a fairly quick response to have something change, but we will take that. Very slow process, but we have been talking about it for a long time. Bit by audio description, moves very slowly. The other area that's going on at the moment is that the Australian Publishers Association, through various lobbying and so forth by ABF and other members of the community and so forth, are pressuring them into releasing what we call an accessible format book. Our goal is to have a book released in an accessible format on the same day at the same price as a normal print book. That's our goal, and that's the objective we keep going to them with. They have acknowledged that Marrakesh will have an impact on their organisation and possibly the members of that group. We did have a meeting last November where I think Emma was there at that one, and Neil Jarvis was there from Roundtable, and we also had the Authors Association, we had a couple of commercial providers, and also some of the publishers. Their idea of what they thought was an accessible format was slightly different to what we thought was an accessible book. I think it's fairly well established that the formats that we've been looking for are braille, large print, and also an accessible format of an e-text that can be read with a screen reader or easily modified to produce another format, or whether that's DAISY or not. They have got a view in their head that a synthetic voice solution would be really easy and quick, and that page numbering, etc., is not that important, because you're only going to read a book, you're not going to. So we have a slight cultural and understanding to get over, and also to ensure that what is what we will eventually hope will be a minimum standard will be one that we feel is responsible and fits the time of where we are in the world. You will understand, however, that They refer to organisations such as Audible and the access to information on the internet, the synthetic readers that are now attached to websites and so forth, and kind of turn around and say, well, what's the problem? There are methods and how you can do it and so forth, but I think we've really got to be very strong and consider that whatever our message is, that it is relating to what we would like as an accessible format in the format of your choice. As you realise, we've now got accessible format through the NDIS. However, that's 4 years after the trial started. So you would think that the organisation would have been able to achieve that. At a recent Senate inquiry, I pointed out that we had a better response from government through FACSIA on accessible information than we do today through the NDIA. The other area that we've been looking at is trying to ensure that with the publishers and with the Copyright Association that we have a consistent message going through. We've joined an alliance with the Australian Digital Alliance so that we reflect their objectives and so forth. The Australian Digital Alliance has members such as Google, etc. And what they're after, of course, is to ensure that copyright is respected, but at the same time is made more accessible, more freely throughout the technical changes that are going on through the world at the moment. So there is a lot of work going on in the area of access to information. It's a very complex area, and we have, I suppose, had a lot of work done by many different members in this room over many, many years. I think, unfortunately, it's the old story. We're having the same argument that we had 15 years ago as we and today. And we had a look at some of our submissions that we made way back in 1995, 99, 2002, and they say exactly the same thing that we've been asking for since then. So it's a very slow process. I'm happy to take any questions or discussion, any items, but I won't guarantee I've got the answer. Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. We've got time for maybe one or two quick questions. Do we have any hands up, microphone runners? Ideally, just one question or comment from the audience, and a question on topic would be fantastic.
Thank you, Dan. I'll try to make it on topic. It's Michael Simpson. John Simpson was expecting me to make a comment about accessible information a while ago, so I don't want to let him down. Tony, central repositories, central catalogues, they're all wonderful notions, but I'm wondering how we can deal with one of the real challenges of that. There are some of us who will recall Sir William Dean launching a body called and a service called ABLES, the Australian Braille Library Service, back in the mid-90s. And that was about bringing all of the Braille collections from around Australia together in a central repository. And that actually occurred. And there was a commitment from all of the blindness agencies that produced Braille to make sure that they continued to contribute to that repository. But 20 years later, we've seen most of those organisations fail on their commitment, and only a couple of agencies now, including Braille Writers in Queensland and Vision Australia, that do still produce a significant amount of literary Braille for general collections.
And your question,
Michael? How do we guarantee that central repositories and central catalogues still see a commitment, not only nationally but internationally, to make sure that content is still developed?
I think what you say, Michael, is quite true. We make these decisions and we move along. I think probably the biggest failing of our sector over the years is not to hold the public library system and the National Library accountable to providing accessible information. In South Australia, they kind of say, well, that's okay, that's your job. With the same with Vision Australia now, everyone says, well, Vision Australia's got a really good audio library, why should we worry about producing any more or trying to get more content and so forth? It's a very hard thing. In some ways, we're giving the community a free kick by providing this information. And I think with the way the sector is moving with the NDIS and My Aged Care and the dropping fundraising because of the Medicare levy and other issues and other pressures, I think we're going to see the ability of the blindness sector to provide this information is going to get harder and harder. I think those who we could end up with the haves and have-nots, those who are being able to afford to buy audible.com books, and those who don't have those resources based on our unemployment figures within the blindness sector, that we will have to, I suppose, continue to run two lines. One is to try and protect what we have and also try and get the commitment through the peak bodies and so forth. At the same time, you all realise that all the agencies are in competition with each other now to survive because under the NDIS it's choice and control. But if the amount of money and effort that goes into ensuring that we have accessible information is not funded by government, it's not funded by people's jobs, it's funded by volunteers and commitment and the effort of the agencies to support where we're going. So we do have to believe in that. But as far as the answer goes, Michael, I suppose it's one of those things, if the resources or the willies drops off and the organisations have different priorities, it's very hard to keep that momentum going. But I think in the world of our sector, we go ensure that the services that are provided and that we've had for the last 130-odd years or so, we make sure that we continue to have it. And that will only come if people ask or participate and ensure that we have funding and so forth.
Would you all please thank Tony Starkey and Lauren Henley for two very excellent and informative presentations. And I now hand over to the MC, Ricky Chaplin.